This is Hurricane Season, a podcast that explores some of the biggest storms that have greatly impacted Greater Houston people and policies. On episode 4, we examine Hurricane Alicia.
In 1961, Hurricane Carla set the benchmark against which all Texas hurricanes were measured for decades. Through the rest of the 60s and all through the 70s, few storms even came close. By the middle of 1983, no tropical cyclone had struck the continental United States in more than 3 years. Texas was overdue. I'm Andrew Schneider. In some ways, Hurricane Alicia has become Houston's forgotten disaster, overlooked between the power of Carla and the floods of Tropical Storm Allison. But at the time it struck, Alicia was one of the most devastating hurricanes ever to hit the U.S. mainland, and it laid the groundwork for how Houston would deal with the aftermath of Harvey 34 years later.
Hurricane Season is a project of the Houston Flood Museum in partnership with Houston Public Media and is supported by Houston Endowment. Visit HoustonFloodMuseum.org.
In August of 1983, Houston was on the verge of passing Philadelphia to become America's fourth largest city. Catherine Whitmire, the city's first female mayor, was on the back half of her first term in office. Through most of that term, Whitmire focused on overhauling city government. Joanne Adams was then Whitmire's assistant director of communications.
We hired not only the city's first black police chief, but the first police chief from outside the department, who subsequently became mayor, Lee Brown. And much of our activities had to do with replacing the staff and putting in a much more effective management team.
The 1983 hurricane season was more than 2 months old, and it had yet to produce a single storm. But on the evening of August 14th, a weak tropical cyclone took shape over the northern Gulf of Mexico, south of New Orleans.
I was the person that was responsible for posting the warnings on Alicia.
Neil Frank was director of the National Hurricane Center, based in Miami.
It was drifting towards the west, and it finally made tropical storm strength, and finally even a Category 1 hurricane. But we weren't really concerned about the development beyond a minimal hurricane.
When Frank joined the Hurricane Center's predecessor in 1961, weather satellites were a brand new technology. By 1983, satellite imagery played a key role in helping to track tropical cyclones. The center had also developed a new probability system. It was a statistical model that helped pinpoint where a storm was likely to make landfall on the coast. Those technological advances could be a big help in dealing with a slow-building storm, but not against one like Alicia.
In the last 18 hours before landfall, the hurricane doubled in strength.
Frank worried that the single route off Galveston Island, the causeway over Galveston Bay, could present a bottleneck for people fleeing the storm. And that was assuming people took the threat of Alicia seriously. Since Hurricane Carla, 22 years earlier, a lot of new homes had gone up on the island's west end, beyond the protection of the Galveston seawall. Many of the newer residents who lived in those homes had never experienced a hurricane in their lives.
And so our concern, as it is today, is will people properly respond to the warnings when you issue them, or will there be some hesitation? And hesitation can lead to loss of life.
Alicia made landfall on the western tip of Galveston Island just before 2 a.m. on August 17th. It arrived as a Category 3, with wind speeds of up to 115 miles per hour. It drove a 10-foot storm surge ahead of it. The seawall held, but other structures weren't so lucky. Alicia ripped the side off the flagship hotel on Galveston's Pleasure Pier, and coastal homes on the west end were wide open to the storm's wrath.
The people on the west end of Galveston Island that couldn't evacuate were able to survive by going up into the second floor and so forth. If Alicia had strengthened to a Category 4 or Category 5, it would have been a huge disaster as far as loss of life.
Those who could evacuate weren't much safer, since the storm swept over the only escape route. Alicia shot northwest over Galveston Bay, straight up the I-45 corridor. It triggered a major oil spill in Texas City, damaged dozens of buildings at NASA's Johnson Space Center, and headed straight for Houston. Clarence West was an attorney serving on Mayor Catherine Whitmire's staff.
At the time, I was living in the Houston Heights, and I remember being home that evening and was probably up late monitoring it when it looked like it was coming in toward Houston.
Mayor Whitmire put her staff on alert, telling them to be ready to respond to the emergency. For West, that meant he would go wherever the mayor needed him.
Either very late evening or very early morning, somebody from the staff called me, and I went to the Civil Defense Emergency Bunker that was downtown across from City Hall.
As the hurricane moved through Houston, the city's tall buildings acted like canyon walls. By narrowing the space for the storm to pass through, they accelerated the force of the wind through the streets. Again, Clarence West.
One of the local reporters, Tim Fleck, and I actually went out through the downtown streets briefly, mid-morning, I suppose, and it was about that time when the glasses in the buildings started breaking.
Alicia scooped up the gravel that insulated the flat roofs of downtown high-rises. The wind ripped apart rooftop air conditioners. The flying debris smashed into the windows of other buildings. The National Research Council ultimately produced a report on the disaster. It included the following account from a spokesman for Houston's Public Works Department, who took shelter from the storm inside a police squad car.
It was a hypnotic thing to watch. A panel would break out, but it wouldn't fall directly to the ground. It would get whipped around by the wind, hit another panel, maybe in the building across the street, and then there would be more broken glass flying around. It seemed to be feeding on itself.
The gravel, metal, and glass threatened anyone unfortunate enough to be caught on the street or inside the buildings. Again, Neil Frank.
Once you break a window in a high rise like that, the wind has access into the interior and you can get a lot of major damage with that.
Further from downtown was Joanne Adams. Mayor Whitmire's assistant communications director was trapped at her home in Montrose.
There was huge rainfall and had been significant rainfall before the hurricane struck. And so the ground was very saturated. And many, many trees blew over, some on cars, some on people, some on houses.
Alicia blew through College Station the next day before weakening and dying out in Oklahoma. The storm left 21 people dead. It inflicted more than $3 billion in damages. Today, that would be worth more than $7 billion. At the time, it was the second costliest storm in U.S. history. As Clarence West remembers, Houston's problems were only beginning.
One of the items we had to deal with was, what do we do with all this debris? It was a tremendous amount of debris, tons.
Broken glass littered the streets, making downtown Houston dangerous for days after. Downed trees and damaged cars blocked the roads. And that was before people started cleaning out their water-damaged homes. Houston had never had to deal with this much wreckage in living memory.
You can't divert all your garbage trucks to picking up debris or soaked household goods.
Joanne Adams said the city needed to find a way to dispose of all that waste. The longer it sat around in piles, the more likely it was to cause a public health crisis.
The city didn't have, and I can't imagine now has, the capacity to handle that kind of cleanup with the people and the equipment that are required.
Plenty of people were ready and willing to help, but the city needed a way to make sure the contractors it hired were competent and reliable. Mayor Whitmire named Adams co-chair of a task force to find a solution.
One of the main things we did, for example, was to come up with a model contract that could be let to get people in there quickly to clean up the debris.
That document was the ancestor of the system Houston uses today to hire contractors to clean up after an emergency. The debris posed another challenge. Just where would all of it go? Clarence West says there was too much to simply dump it all in a landfill.
They set up four or five sites around Houston where a bulldozer would literally dig a fairly deep trench. There would be wood, which would be burning, and they would blow air into it, so it would burn super hot, would have very little smoke. And that's where they burned all the tree limbs all over the city, and those went on for quite a while.
There were also smaller matters to address. No one wanted to have to deal with flying rocks again.
Well, we determined that the code, the Houston code, that specified the size of the rocks that would be on the top of buildings had to be larger.
Houston voters rewarded Whitmire's handling of Alicia that November, re-electing her by a landslide. Joanne Adams went on to become her communications director and later chief of staff. Adams said they kept lessons of the cleanup handy.
We had to create all of that at the time, and so we documented it for the future. We never, while we were in office, never had an opportunity to experience anything like that again.
Catherine Whitmire served until 1991, one of only two mayors in Houston's history to win five consecutive two-year terms. The city wouldn't face another cleanup like Alicia's until after Harvey, but its next trial would come much sooner.
Hurricane Season is produced by Andrew Schneider, Davis Land, Todd Holslander, and me, Maggie Martin. We also had help in this episode from Mark DiClaudio. You can listen to this episode of Hurricane Season and subscribe by going to HoustonPublicMedia.org/Harvey. On the next episode of Hurricane Season, we revisit Tropical Storm Allison.